Gateway News. I'm Victor Beatty. Presidents Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin held their first formal summit Monday in Helsinki, Finland, speaking through an interpreter. Mr. Putin said their private talks were frank and businesslike, but
I think we can call it a success and a very fruitful round of negotiations.
He said the bilateral relationship is going through a complicated stage, but hope for improvement. Mr. Trump described the talks as direct, open, and productive.
The disagreements between our two countries are well known, and President Putin and I discussed them at length. But if we're going to solve many of the problems facing our world, then we're going to have to find ways to cooperate in pursuit of shared interests.
They discussed arms control in Syria. Little was said about Russia's annexation of Crimea, other than to agree to disagree. Mr. Trump said both countries were at fault for the poor state of relations. He declined to accuse Russia of election meddling, but took aim at the lengthy U.S. investigation into allegations of collusion between Russia and Mr. Trump's 2016 presidential campaign.
I think that the probe is a disaster for our country. I think it's kept us apart. It's kept us separated. There was no collusion at all. Everybody knows it.
Mr. Putin repeated the Russian state had no involvement in the election.
And I had to reiterate things I said several times, including during our personal contacts, that the Russian state has never interfered and is not going to interfere into internal American affairs, including election process.
Florida Democratic Senator Bill Nelson said Mr. Trump was acting in the interests of his Russian counterpart.
This just confounds me, and I think the president is going to have to backtrack on this.
He said the president's disagreement is bewildering. Dozens of Nigerian soldiers are dead, wounded, or missing following two separate attacks in northeastern Nigeria by suspected Boko Haram insurgents. This is VOA News. Syrian state media said pro-government forces have taken control of a strategic hill overlooking the Israeli-occupied Golan Heights as it seizes the remnants of rebel-controlled territory. The Al-Hara Hill had been a key part of Syria's defenses against Israel. American University Professor Emeritus Russell Stone said this is alarming.
Not so much because of the Syrian army's role. Israel has resigned to the fact the Syrian army and the Syrian Assad Syrian government is going to reassert control over all of Syria. It's the concern with the allies, namely Iran and Hezbollah, the Shiite military group from Lebanon, that Israel is very concerned not to have, not only not in the border area, but not in Syria altogether.
Israel has threatened a harsh response if its Syrian forces deploy in the UN disengagement observer zone just a few kilometers away. Israeli warplanes Monday hit two Hamas targets in Gaza in response to the launching of balloons over southern Israel with firebombs that have burned farmland. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu visited southern Israel after the two sides exchanged airstrikes and rocket and mortar fire Saturday. British Prime Minister Theresa May won a series of votes Monday in Parliament, bolstering her plan to divorce from the European Union called Brexit. But to do so, her government accepted four amendments to a customs bill from lawmakers who want a complete break from Brussels.
The ayes to the right, 305. The noes to the left, 302.
The measure, which goes to the upper house, prevents Britain from collecting tariffs on behalf of EU nations unless the EU does the same for Britain. Hundreds of migrants aboard two EU Border Patrol ships disembarked in Sicily Monday, following an agreement between Italy's populist government and other EU member states to take in some of the migrants. The ships were prevented from docking for 2 days until Rome reached agreement with Portugal, Spain, and Germany. Eritrea reopened its embassy in Ethiopia Monday, the latest sign of improved ties between the two former Horn of Africa enemies. Both leaders, Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed and Eritrean leader Isaias Afwerki, were on hand for the ceremony in Addis Ababa. A lava from Hawaii's Kilauea volcano caused explosions as it entered colder seawater, sending molten rock through the roof of one sightseeing boat off the Big Island, injuring more than 20 people. U.S. stocks were mixed in Monday trading. The benchmark Dow Jones gained nearly 45 points to 25,064. Oil prices in Asia have rallied after slumping severely as Libyan ports reopened on Monday. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
Good morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, and today is Tuesday, July the 17th, and here are some of the stories we are covering for you this morning. Former Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf and former interim president of the Central African Republic, Catherine Samba Panza, will co-lead a joint observer delegation for the July 30th elections in Zimbabwe. And former U.S. President Barack Obama is in South Africa, where he will give a keynote speech marking the 100th birthday of anti-apartheid leader Nelson Mandela. He travels to South Africa after making a stop in Kenya, where he spoke at a launch of his sister's foundation. Speaking to Kenyan youth, Mr. Obama stressed the need for youth empowerment for development to occur in Africa.
So what we see here in Kenya is all part of an emergent, more confident, and more self-reliant Africa.
Former U.S. President Barack Obama. In Malawi, the opposition says that its government is withholding funds from the National Initiative for Civic Education as part of a plan to rig next year's elections.
Come elections, if the leaders are very strong, they should not even be afraid and start rigging by not even educating people in the mass in the areas. How important it is to register.
Patricia Kaliati is an opposition parliamentarian from the United Transformation Movement. And South African President Cyril Ramaphosa has appointed a team of business and finance experts to try and bring in $100 billion in investments. The money is needed to boost the ailing economy. Those stories and more are coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. Former U.S. President Barack Obama arrived in Kenya on Sunday for his first visit to Africa since leaving the White House. He spoke at the small village that was his late father's homeland. Raya Rombour reports from Nairobi.
This is the fifth time that Obama has visited Kenya, his father's birthplace. Upon arriving in Nairobi on Sunday, he held talks with Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta and opposition leader Raila Odinga. On Monday, he inaugurated the Sauti Kuu Foundation, a sports and vocational training center set up by his half-sister in the small western Kenya town of Kogelo. Kogelo was the hometown of Barack Obama Sr. The former president last visited the village in 2006 when he was a U.S. senator. In his speech Monday, Obama stressed the need for youth empowerment for development to occur in Africa.
It begins with our young people in places like this. All of us providing the educational and economic and cultural opportunities that can empower some of the remarkable young people that you saw here today with the skills and the self-reliance to first change their own lives and then change their communities.
The former president applauded efforts by Kenyatta and Odinga to work together after a prolonged and disputed presidential election in 2017.
So there's been real progress in this amazing country, and it should inspire today's young Kenyans to demand even more progress. The good news is Kenya has a new constitution. It has a new spirit of investment and entrepreneurship. Despite some of the tumultuous times that seem to attend every election, we now have a president and a major opposition leader who have pledged to build bridges and have made specific commitments to work together. So what we see here in Kenya is all part of an emergent, more confident, and more self-reliant Africa.
Obama also urged Kenyans to move past the ethnic tensions that have fueled violence during past election cycles and root out corruption that limits Kenya's economic growth.
It means no longer seeing different ethnicities as enemies or rivals, but rather as allies, and seeing the diversity of tribes not as a weakness, but as a strength. It means making sure that economic growth reaches everyone and not just a few at the top, that it's broadly shared across regions. It means guaranteeing educational opportunity to everybody, not just our boys, but also our girls, because the nation that gives our daughters the same opportunities as our sons is more likely to succeed.
The former U.S. president left Monday evening for South Africa, where he will deliver the 16th annual Nelson Mandela Lecture in Johannesburg. Raya Lombor for VOA News, Nairobi.
And from Kenya, Mr. Obama will travel to South Africa, where he's meant to deliver the 16th annual Nelson Mandela Lecture. The lecture honors the late Nobel Peace Prize winner's 100th birthday. It also happens one day before Nelson Mandela International Day, an annual holiday declared by United Nations in 2009. And from Johannesburg, South Africa, Tuso Kumalo reports.
All roads on Tuesday will lead to Wanderers Stadium in Johannesburg to hear what former U.S. President Obama has to say about the legacy of former South African President Nelson Mandela. He will speak one day before what would have been the late icon's 100th birthday and one day before Nelson Mandela International Day, an annual holiday declared by the United Nations in 2009. Luzuko Koti, Communications Director at the Nelson Mandela Foundation, says about 15,000 people are expected to attend, including several former heads of states from Africa and former U.S. President Jimmy Carter.
We are actually ready to roll. Tomorrow morning, the lecture is happening, and I think all of the people who have asked to be here or invited to be here, they will be having a good experience tomorrow.
The Mandela Foundation, which is hosting the event in partnership with Mutsipe Foundation and the Obama Foundation, says the objective of the yearly lecture is to encourage people to discover their own strength and use it to change others' lives. Koti says the current global challenges led them to decide that Obama was the right person to deliver this year's lecture.
We looked at a person who can spread the message globally, who has a global platform and a global voice, who can raise the questions that are uncomfortable that we would like people to engage with. How do we become active citizens to solve the problems that we face? So he was a perfect speaker to give us that.
Obama's speech is expected to focus on the need for better shelter, education, literacy and food security for the people of South Africa and other nations. This is Obama's first visit to South Africa since he came for Mandela's funeral in December 2013. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
And we stay in Southern Africa, where U.S. pro-democracy groups, International Republican Institute, IRI, and the National Democratic Institute, NDI, say that they are sending two former African presidents to Zimbabwe to head their joint observer mission delegation for the July 30 elections. Sebastian Moff reports from Harare that the polls in his country are attracting international attention.
The International Republican Institute and the National Democratic Institute say former Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf and former interim president of the Central African Republic, Catherine Samba Panza, will co-lead a joint observer delegation for the July 30th polls in Zimbabwe. Jessica Kagan, the co-director of these two U.S. pro-democrats groups, Zimbabwe Election Observer Mission, talks to VOA about the deployment of the two former African leaders.
Their collective presence as leadership to our delegation here reflects the significance of these historic elections for the Zimbabwean people, as these elections will not only be significant for Zimbabwe, but also for all of Africa. IRI and NDI have a long history of supporting democratic processes in Zimbabwe, and we hope that through this international election observation mission, our presence will help contribute to a more credible electoral process that's reflective of the will of the people.
The two former African presidents, Samba Panza and Johnson Sirleaf, will be joined by U.S. Congresswoman Karen Bass and the two former U.S. Assistant Secretaries of State for Africa, Connie Barry Newman and Johnny Carson. Meanwhile, the former United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan is later this week in Harare leading a group of the elders, his organization said Monday. The Ghanaian former UN diplomat comes with the elders group ahead of the country's first elections without founding leader Robert Mugabe after his resignation last November. The July 30th polls are the first ones in years that Zimbabwe has allowed observers from the West. Under Robert Mugabe's nearly 40-year old regime, Western observers would be deemed as biased against the ruling ZANU-PF party. But Mugabe's successor, President Emmerson Mnangagwa, has said he has nothing to hide and he has let Western observers into the country. However, the opposition says the ruling ZANU-PF party and state security officials are still manipulating the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission just as they did when Mugabe was still in power. Zimbabwe's main opposition party, the Movement for Democratic Change, led by former student activist Nelson Chamisa, has already challenged the early voting by some police officers last week, which it says is part of vote rigging by the country's election body in favor of the ruling ZANU-PF party. Sebastian Mofu for VOA Daybreak Africa, Harare.
In East Africa, Uganda's main opposition party, the Forum for Democratic Change, or FDC, is calling on members of parliament to reject the newly introduced taxes on mobile money transfers and social media. Leaders of the opposition say that the opposition will do everything it can in its power to ensure that the new taxes are suspended. And from Kampala, Uganda, reporter Mugume Davis Rwakarenji files this report.
Patrick Amriat, the president of FDC, says the people of Uganda and the parliament at large will not support the new taxes. Amriat says the taxes will deprive ordinary citizens of their right to expression and reduce business transactions among merchants.
This mobile money tax is a repugnant tax. It's just going to slow down the economy. It is going to cause unemployment and inconvenience in transacting business.
Uganda's parliament was called from recess this week to debate on the newly introduced controversial taxes. Since the beginning of this month, social media users have had to pay 200 Uganda shillings daily so as to be able to access social media sites like Twitter, WhatsApp, Facebook, Instagram, and others. Equally, a 1% tax was introduced on mobile money transactions. Uganda's President Yoweri Kaguta Museveni last week said he signed a new law introducing these taxes by a mistake. He admitted that new taxes, especially mobile money transactions, was a burden to ordinary citizens. He said he would ask members of the parliament to discuss and amend these new tax laws. Opposition member of parliament, Paul Mwiru, describes the new taxes as a double taxation.
As we talk now, there are transaction charges being levied by the telephone companies on its customers in as far as the mobile money services is concerned in the country. And every transaction charge, there is 30%, for which 12% is excise duty and 18% VAT, so which is 30%. We are saying no, there already exists a tax. Because even what government is trying to introduce, it's not even calling it a tax. It's a deduction on someone's money without any explanation.
Mwiru says the new taxes mainly affect the very vulnerable in the country.
We have seen where they are charging 1% on tax on even bulk payments, which are made to refugees, to youth groups, to group workers like casual laborers. Yet, even these refugees, that's a stipend where they're not supposed to pay a tax. When it comes to the youth, this money from government and NGOs, which is not supposed to be taxed. So at the end of the day, we are saying government should look for better ways actually of levying a tax other than through introducing a tax on a tax.
The Information, Communication and Technology Association of Uganda, an umbrella of ICT, private sector, companies and professionals in Uganda, told VOA last week that the new taxes were introduced without proper consultation. The association says the new taxes will constrain the development of industry, economy and the society. For VOA News, I am Mugume, Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
Malawi's information minister has rejected accusations that the government plans to rig next year's elections due to President Arthur Peter Mutharika's unpopularity. Nicholas Dausi says that the government continues to demonstrate commitment to the rule of law and remains confident that the Electoral Commission will organize free, fair and credible elections. The information minister's remarks came after Patricia Kaliati, an opposition parliamentarian from the United Transformation Movement, accused the government of withholding funds from the National Initiative for Civic Education as part of that plan to rig the elections. This, the parliamentarian says, prevents the government agency from carrying out its core mandate, which she says is to educate Malawians to register to vote. She adds that the lack of funds is a voter apathy strategy aimed to rig the elections, an accusation the information minister sharply denies. Meanwhile, the Malawi Electoral Commission is compiling a voter list to be used for the 2019 polls. And for more about her accusations regarding the elections, VOA's Peter Cloti reached Mrs. Kaliati in the capital, Lilongwe.
That department was even created by government in itself. I thought maybe government was supposed to champion and start really educating people around the villages how to register, how important it is. But now they're playing tactics, they don't do that. We hear, and the responsibility of NEC as well. NEC is supposed to go around and have even conferences, telling the chiefs, meeting at the ADC level, telling them that they've got to parade their subjects for a decision. But I think they want to defeat democracy, because democracy is supposed to be protected, and democracy is supposed to be empowered, nurtured. They maybe started linking the elections. But let me assure you, Mr. Voice of America, if they think of rigging elections, tell them that the elections themselves are going to rig them. They will never even do that. The people that are very clever, they're intelligent, they're able to know what is happening, and we are able to trust even where they are doing things and what they are doing. We keep recording of all those registered voters each and every day. When they're finishing, we know how many they've registered. So they cannot trick us, they cannot even lie. If they think they can top up on top of those registers and they're registering ghost voters, that will not even work.
Mrs. Kaliati, Nicholas Dawusi, the information minister, dismissed your accusations that the DPP wants to use the poor nature, as you described the civic education department, to rig the election, says this is a demonstration of the lack of knowledge about how the national civic education works. How do you respond to that?
Mr. Dawusi cannot even say we are accusing them because they didn't even hear what I've responded. So I think they're responding to their own shadows, of which they know that people were able to trace their shadows. So they're just responding to that, because they didn't even hear me talking to this. You are the first person asking me about civic education and the leading of elections. So if they were responding on that, I think they are responding to whatever they are doing, which is really very unfortunate. They are the very same people doing that, they are the very same people coming forward, responding to you as if we've told them that this is what you've identified and this is what you've felt, which is really very unfortunate. Mr. Voice of America, what you ask me is the responsibility of government, not me. They're supposed to tell us that they're there for the people. They're supposed to tell me that they're there to do the job. Come elections. If leaders are very strong, they should not even be afraid and start reading by not even educating people in the areas how important it is to register, and also how important it is for them to go vote in some 20th of May 2019.
Mrs. Kaliati, do you have confidence in the Malawi Electoral Commission to organize free, fair, and transparent elections next year?
As far as today, I doubt, because legislation has already started, and they are not even going around civic educating the mass. I think they know what they are doing. But they've got to know that this is the world. They've got to know that we are all at a lookout and we know who is doing what. So they better do their job properly as professionals. And they've got to challenge us that they are professionals, that they're going to do the job well. But now, knowing that there are those closeness amongst some of these people, then we doubt that they're going to work according to that. But I believe that those who are there, they are really professionals, I think they're going to do their job. And what they've got to do is to leave friendship aside, to leave whatever aside, and do their job properly. And I will pat them at their back if they'll do that.
You were recently part of the ruling DPP party. You had supported the president. What happened that you decided to go away and support Vice President Silas Chilima? What happened before you decided to go your way?
Dr. Silas Chilima was the one also who contributed to us for this party to be in government. He's the one who contributed to the elections of 2014 to win. So there's no way that one should come and insinuate us as if he voted for himself. Politics should not defeat democracy. Sociology should not defeat democracy. Environment should not defeat democracy. Legal system where people are not using their manifesto and their constitution do not even defeat democracy. And also the economy, whereby we are looking into, whereby Malawi we are at 0.5 to 0.9, the Gini coefficient. But now for us to work and for the sake of the Malawians, would like to see the G coefficients to be the gene coefficients to be at 0.5 to 0.2. We've been in the devolving country for a number of years, 54 years of our independence. We have a lot of things which we are not even asked, we are not even giving to our voters, to our people. Time has come that we need to see people who've been in Malawi, who've been educated in Malawi, who've grown up in Malawi, born in Malawi, and employed in Malawi, and employ others in Malawi. Those are the ones who are able to identify the challenges of Malawians, and they're the ones who are going to give the basic amenities to the Malawians.
That is Patricia Kaliati, an opposition parliamentarian from the United Transformation Movement, an opposition party in Malawi. She was speaking to VOA's Peter Clody from the capital, Lilongwe. African farms need to increase their mechanization methods. This is according to a new report out this month from the Malabo Multiplier Panel, which says that African farmers have 10 times fewer mechanized tools per farm than other developing nations. The BC Araba Regional Director for Africa at the CGA International Center for Tropical Agriculture speaks to Ricky Shryok about how farming needs to be regarded as a business on the continent and ways to do that.
Most farmers still practice rain-fed agriculture, meaning there's very little leeway to the vagaries of weather and climate. And of course, there's also the low level of mechanization. So a lot of the farmers still use hoes and cutlasses, in some cases, animal-drawn equipment. The level of productivity is just too low to ensure that African agriculture can be competitive globally. And this is a problem. What we're trying to do with the mechanized report of the Malabo Montpellier panel is to critically bring this issue to the attention of decision makers and those who invest in agriculture, not just national governments, but donors and also private sector.
Who are those people who are investing in agriculture, or I guess people who are not investing in agriculture?
One way we can look at this is by approaching agriculture as a business. So if you take all the various value chain actors, whether it's the farmer or the person involved in storage, preservation, processing, distribution, logistics, etc., as businesses, then what we're trying to do is link the agriculture activities to market. When we start that, then we can attract the necessary financing required to upgrade agricultural practices and incorporate modern technology and mechanization into their practices to increase productivity. So we're already seeing, in West Africa, we're already seeing an aggregation of farmland. The medium-scale farms, the 5 to 100-hectare-sized farms, are starting to increase because we're getting more urban, you know, people with, whether it's the growing middle class in urban areas who are looking to invest in agriculture, who are buying up more land, aggregating more family land, or purchasing land outright.
Is the aid world or the development world at all a hurdle, despite whether they're well-meaning or not, a hurdle in these kind of activities?
Without being critical of anyone's interventions or engagement in agriculture, I would like to reiterate, agriculture is a business. We should not romanticize the idea of a farmer on his or his farm with a hoe, or a woman with a baby on her back, strapped to her back, you know, tilling the soil. It's back-breaking work. The whole point of mechanization is to eliminate drudgery from agriculture, whether on farm or off farm. So the only way you can try to shift the focus or shift the agenda of decision makers or people in decision making positions is to show them the evidence.
That was the BC Araba's Regional Director for Africa at the CGA International Center for Tropical Agriculture. He's based in Nairobi, but was speaking to Ricky Shryok from the U.S. And that's it for this Tuesday, July the 17th edition of Daybreak Africa. Join us again tomorrow for more African news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a very good day, Africa.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, the upset-filled 2018 FIFA World Cup wraps up on Sunday. All five of the teams from Africa, Nigeria, Egypt, Senegal, Morocco and Tunisia were knocked out in the preliminary rounds. A discussion on the World Cup on Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.